This is Geekspeak, episode 21 of our 16th season, shining sunlight on the FBI's backspace button. Welcome to Geekspeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Mr. Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
How's it going?
Good. And Ben Jaffe, a programmer, musician, and video geek.
Hello.
Hello. Today we're going to start with Miles and find out about solar cell efficiency.
A group from the University of North South Wales, that would be Australia for those who are not geographically
North South
inclined.
Wales?
Yes. Have produced a new milestone for solar cell efficiency. Got to about 35%, I believe, or 34.5%. And this was without a concentrator. So you may have heard in the past people have gotten to like 40 or something like that. That's because they've had either Fresnel lens or something like that that's taking a wider area and putting it onto a smaller PV junction. This one is actually, that's the area. It's using the solar constant of 1 kilowatt hour per square meter as your base. And it was able
clarify what that base is. Why do you mean that as a base for solar energy?
The amount of energy equivalent that the sun hits every square meter on the planet, or
at the equator,
the average,
in the summer,
the average on the planet in direct sunlight is 1 kilowatt per square meter.
Okay, so the if you had 100% efficiency of sun capture, you'd have 1 kilowatt per square meter.
Right. If
that seems really high.
Technically, in the if you were in orbit or something like that, you'd be able to get something like 1.367 kilowatt hours. Or kilowatts, I should say. It's the instantaneous measure.
Sure.
And so we just kind of round off to, or at least I round off, just because there is cloud cover, is atmosphere.
When you said 1 kilowatt, I thought, wow, is that part of the metric spec? Like sun output on Earth? That seems, because it was such an even number, and lots of times you'll find that, you know, to raise, you know, what's 1 degree?
1.367 is the solar constant on Earth.
Okay. Okay, so let's just say it's 1 kilowatt. Per square meter. So what you're saying is if you could get that efficiency, that would be perfect. And this group got what efficiency?
34.5%. So
that's really
good. If you had a theoretical of 1 kilowatt, that means you get 350 watts.
Or so.
Yeah.
So
per square meter.
So, and what you said is this a traditional, is this a voltaic that's directly transferring? It's not a collector based? Is that what you're saying?
Right. It is not a concentrator.
Not a concentrator. Now, there are two types of concentrators that I am aware of. One is that you reflect a whole bunch of light into a cell that is a photovoltaic.
So you've got like a whole bunch of mirrors and they're all pointing at the same location. They're pointing all the sunlight.
Yeah, and you could at that location do two things. You could transfer the photons into electricity, or you could use the photons to heat some kind of material like a salt liquid, and then pump that through and use a traditional turbine to, you know, steam gas, steam water, and then make a turbine situation.
Heat something up and then turn something, and then convert the turning motion into electricity, which we've been doing for a long, long, long time.
Condense the water, rinse, repeat.
Right. Yeah. And so what you're saying is this is not a condenser. The condensers, are they traditionally
concentrator?
Are they more efficient?
They are more efficient. What they are doing is instead of being just a flat wafer, it is more complex in that it has a triangular aspect to it. So one part of the light spectrum gets reflected off, goes to another collector. Part of it goes through.
So you're doing a prism thing.
Yes,
so
it's a prism.
You have tuned photovoltaics that work at different frequencies of light, and then you use your mirror to actually split the light into the prismatic effect, and then you are more efficient in your collection.
Right, or a lens,
But of course, what's happening there is you're still going to take up a lot of space. So it's not like you could put a lot more of those on the planet, if you will. But if you look at the actual square footage, you're more efficient into uptake.
Right. Okay, cool. Well, I mean, no matter how efficient you make a solar cell, you're never going to get above that solar – you're never going to get more out than the sun puts in. And that's where that solar constant comes into play. So if they can scale that technology up, and you will probably see more photovoltaics having that prism effect to collect more light, of that light energy, we should be seeing a much brighter future. Yeah. See what I did there?
So I saw an interesting video that I hadn't known before. I hadn't known this before, that the strip of Las Vegas is actually not part of Las Vegas City.
This is the strip of hotels.
Yeah, like Las Vegas Strip, which has all the hotels and all the casinos of Worth,
I assume that that was in Las Vegas.
It's not in Las Vegas City. So you know, you understand the idea of there's, you know, country, state, county
and then city, yeah.
And normally, if you're
an unincorporated area, yeah.
Yeah, and a county is an unincorporated area. So normally a county...
A county contains all of the area and some of it is incorporated.
Right.
Some of it in a city,
right,
or
so
a town.
What we'd say is that the county has cities and those cities exist and are incorporated.
Right.
And each of the cities can have its own taxes and rules. And so when the boom of Vegas happened, some people went, you know what, instead of being part of the city of Las Vegas, let's be right outside the city and then we won't have to pay city taxes. And they paid the county directly and then made rules about the buildings through the county. And relatively soon after that point, the county was like, yeah, you're an unincorporated forever area called Paradise. So the area that the strip is in is actually called Paradise.
Oh, that
within Clark County.
Within the county.
The strip is not Paradise.
If you look on a map, it's called Paradise. And it's unincorporated. And of course, there's no police force, right? But the casinos handle that. And there's no water system from the city because the casinos handle that.
Well, Las Vegas used to be the mob.
Right.
So the casinos handle that.
Yeah, exactly. Any stories from Vegas area, Miles?
Stories from the Vegas area?
Sure. Like a solar, I don't know, we're talking about solar energy, so maybe
There was an issue where, I just want to bring up the old adage that is, if a fossil fuel plant, has a bad day, there's an explosion. If a nuclear power plant has a bad day, there's a meltdown. If a solar power plant has a bad day, it's a beautiful day.
Oh, I see, because it has a spill of solar energy, and it right. just means it's like a nice sunset or something.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's not the case at Ivanpah, which is a solar thermal plant. That's what you were talking about earlier, where you're using mirrors to concentrate on a single thing to melt salt, a molten salt. And that's for being able to provide electricity, not just when the sun is shining, but also that thermal mass to go into the evenings.
Right. So they're basically heating up this ball of salt, sodium, really, really hot, and then the heat goes through the night.
Right.
And that also means you're concentrating a lot of energy on this one particular place.
Right. And you also have to watch out for planes. Some pilots have talked about how they get blinded by
light
from there. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that would be a problem.
Because the sun constantly moves. So all of those mirrors cannot be stationary. They have to track in order to keep the focal point on that that thermal mass.
That makes sense.
Now, they do have mirrors that are going to be off as they do maintenance and they rotate in and out. And also as the shadow of the tower itself, of the collector, passes over the mirrors, then they aren't really an issue.
They're not useful.
And the issue comes into play where one of those mirrors may be under maintenance or out of position, and it ended up not hitting the tower at the top where the solar thermal masses, it instead hit lower down on the tower where there was a bunch of electrical cabling.
Oh, no.
Oh, so they slightly missed. Yeah, not good.
Yeah, not all of them, but enough of them. And so it sparked a fire.
Oh, no.
And so did the whole tower go up?
No, but it did cause a fair amount of damage, and it was taken offline.
You know, the thing about the pilots saying that they'd be blinded by these arrays?
No, have stated that they were...
I get that they've stated that, but if the array is online and the sun is shining, the mirror bounces that light, the sunlight, from that mirror onto the collector. That's the angle that it goes to. So why would it be aimed at an airplane?
Well, I mean, an airplane could fly anywhere overhead, and if any of that light misses the tower, then they've basically got a sun bouncing off of a mirror down there.
Yeah, but missing the tower is the point there, right? If you have a really good efficient system, all the sunlight that hits the mirror will hit the collector.
Right.
That's
two things. One, you said if, that's the magic conditional word, right? And not all systems are 100% efficient. As engineers, we all know this. Yeah. And then also what you had mentioned, Miles, of like if a mirror is offline for maintenance or something like that, you can't just turn off a mirror.
Right. And there's
I
also
mean,
the
you just stop
of,
pointing it actively. Yeah,
there's also the aspect of when you have a mirror, I'm sure you've seen this before, where the mirror, if it's directly, you know, the sun hitting the mirror and going directly to your eyes, yes, very bright. But it doesn't have to be directly at you for several of the mirrors to be very much brighter than the ambient area.
Right. So, like, if you were, let's imagine that you were standing on top of the salt tower, which probably would be a really bad idea, right? But let's just imagine, and the system was 100% efficient, and all of the light that was being aimed was hitting the salt tower as it should, you're still going to see a lot of brightness. Because, yeah. you know, yeah. it's kind
There's
of like if you
too,
cover up the sun with your thumb, you still the area around the sun is really bright.
Yeah. All right. Shall we move on? Speaking sure. of solar energy, let's talk about other solar
Oh,
events.
Yeah. Actually, I have a story that combines solar and planes, believe it or not.
Oh, good.
I'll get to the plane in just a second.
You know, let me interrupt real quick and just
please.
Let you know, the video that I was talking about that told me all about the Vegas versus Paradise area was by CGP Gray.
CGP Gray?
CGP Gray just discovered his YouTube channel. I've been listening to his podcast called Hello Internet for quite a while. He does it with the person that does Number File.
Okay.
Both those video chats are great. CGP Gray's stuff is wonderful. Ben, you will absolutely love it. I'll link to
like,
it.
Like, what's it about?
He does explanation videos, and he uses stick figures and really good. He's written it beforehand. He's recorded it. It's just imagery with his voice over it and stick figures to explain things.
Explanations plus stick figures.
I knew you'd. It's in your wheelhouse, man.
Yeah, definitely. I love XKCD.
It's very similar to that in a lot of ways.
A webcomic.
CGP Gray, and I'll link the actual story, the video as well. Okay.
I wonder what CGP stands for.
I think that might be his name, but I'm not really sure.
Do you know what XKCD stands for?
No.
No one knows.
No one knows because it's just four letters that he said he could find a domain name for.
That's awesome. I have one of those too.
Right, do you? So this story is also a video, great for radio, or podcasts. But this is actually a story. It was a blog post that Phil Plait wrote. Phil Plait is also known as the Bad Astronomer. He writes a fantastic, fantastic blog on Slate.com. And he talks about astronomy and everything. And he just always has his facts right and everything. Very, very good blogger. Cool guy. He posted a video about the Mercury transit. And this is where Mercury passes in between us and the sun. So kind of like a solar eclipse, but instead of it being the moon, it's Mercury. And apparently the guy who Phil Plait posted this guy's video, his name was, and I don't speak French, but something like Terry Legault or something.
Okay.
L-E-G-A-U-L-T, Miles.
Yeah, that sounds right.
All right. Awesome. I wasn't expecting you to get it right. In any case, he apparently had to travel to Pennsylvania. He's from France to get the geometry for this particular video just right. But he recorded a time lapse. Basically, he pointed his camera at the sun, and he recorded basically video.
First off, don't do this unless you have the right filters.
Oh, yeah. Don't do it.
Especially don't ever look through a lens at the sun.
Just don't look at the sun. Through a lens or not.
Just saying.
But he captured, of course, Mercury going across the sun. It's a little dot kind of scooting across the sun. But he lined it up just right, and he traveled to Pennsylvania to get this right, that the International Space Station also goes across the sun. So occludes? Not occludes.
Yeah, yeah.
Transits.
Transits. Oh, man.
That's
you're
the
good.
Word. I
nice
said that.
Done,
I said that
dude.
A little earlier in the story, and I forgot it. Not only that, but just because of a little bit of luck, he got an actual plane transiting the sun as well. So there's Mercury, this teeny little dot. Then there's the International Space Station, which is much, much, it's much smaller, but it's way, way, way closer. And so it's quite a bit bigger. And then there's this plane. It's just...
And is it a lot bigger?
It's huge. It's like the size of the sun because of the size of the plane and the very close distance.
Oh, that's cool.
But smaller than the space station.
But smaller than... No, bigger than the space station. Seriously,
the plane is smaller, but
The plane is physically smaller, but because it was...
That's what I mean. Like, you're going from very large celestial object to artificial satellite to plane.
To, like, teeny Cessna or
something. And so you're going from big to much smaller to even smaller, as opposed
to...
But they're
appearing
very small, larger, very large.
A couple things that are really cool about this.
It's like a college conversation when people get stoned.
Dude, it was bigger. What is bigger? No, it's smaller. No, it's bigger.
No, like, it was bigger, but it was smaller at the same time.
I think we
understand. It is vast. It contains multitudes.
But speaking of the ISS.
Oh, I just also wanted to say one really cool thing about this video is when the plane goes across, you can see all of the vortices of the air, of the way that the plane interacts with the air. Mm-hmm. It's really, really cool because you're looking at a massive amount of light coming through the atmosphere, and so you see the diffraction of the light as the moving air changes the trajectory of the light.
Mm-hmm.
It's really awesome. Cool. And speaking of the International Space Station just completed its 100,000th orbit around the Earth.
That's a lot of orbits.
That's
how many days is that?
A lot of times, round and round. Well, it takes them 90 minutes to orbit the Earth.
Okay.
So I don't know. What would that be? That would be 24. Oh, God. I'm not going to do this right now.
No, I don't think it's important to do it now.
Yeah, but in any case, just some facts about the ISS. They're about 250 miles up, 400 kilometers up. And they're traveling at about 17,500 miles per hour or 28,000 kilometers per hour. So they're going like they're just buzzing around the Earth really, 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 really fast. They're circling once every 90 minutes. And now, because of the 100,000 orbits, they have now traveled around the Earth 2.6 billion miles, which is about the distance of 10 round trips to Mars.
Cool.
Which, like, puts into perspective for me, like, this thing has been going around and around and around and around and around really, 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 really fast for a really, really, really long time.
Revolution every 90 minutes.
It's only gone 10 round trips to Mars, which to me says Mars is really far away.
It's really like, far away.
Whoa. Anyway, pretty exciting.
Greg says 17.12 years.
17
is how long it's been
17.12 years.
17.12 years is how long it's, or 6,250 hours. Thanks, Greg, for whipping up your calculator. And that's, of course, how long the space station's been orbiting, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Yeah. Remind me not to try to do math while I'm talking on a podcast.
No.
Not good.
All right. Let's get into some social stuff, some law stuff, shall we?
Back down to Earth.
Yes. A judge has told a suspect, this suspect is a person who had some Tor malware, there's some Tor malware that enabled the FBI to bust a child porn ring. And
okay.
So they had a suspect that they got as a result of this malware that got onto the person's system.
Okay, so Tor is a network to be completely anonymous on the internet. Normally you're not anonymous. Tor allows you to be anonymous, theoretically.
So if you browse the web through the Tor network, then you are theoretically anonymous.
Right. But it's possible also when people download the Tor system, they normally have to install some software, including a browser, and it's sometimes not uncommon for those packages to be distributed, but them to be infected by a piece of malware.
Right. So you get the person before they get on the Tor network.
Right. We call that Tor malware because it's kind of targeting Tor users. That's why it's called that. So the FBI probably created some Tor malware software, mm-hmm. put it out there, and then people grabbed that software. Then they looked at what they were doing and seeing that software was legal and were able to bust some people that were engaged in child pornography. Okay.
The accused is saying that, no, this isn't me, and I want to see this software that says that it was able to find me. I want to be able to look at the source code to see, you know, what happened so he can mount a defense.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a touchy subject because, you know, frankly, you know, no one likes a person who dabbles in child porn. Like, it's one of the biggest taboos in most societies.
Totally. And let's go ahead and go with the whole he hasn't been prosecuted yet and therefore he's innocent.
Yeah, the suspect, yeah.
But this is an interesting idea. He's a suspect and he basically is kind of asking for the right to know his accuser. right? Because he's being accused of it by a piece of software, and this piece of software is complex. And he's asking to look at the source code of that software so that it's equivalent to like a mantra that we have. I think it goes back from Magna Carta,
yeah,
where you're supposed
habeas
to be able
corpus,
to—
the show us the body, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you're also supposed to be able to— the person that's accusing you, you're supposed to be able to know who they are. That's part of the mm-hmm. rules of our court. So what's the judge say in this situation?
So the judge said that the suspect does indeed have the right to review the code.
Uh-huh.
But he also ruled that the FBI has a right to keep the code secret.
Hmm?
What?
Yes, it's a total—
the judge is saying the same thing?
This Kafka-esque, yeah—
is the judge turning one direction saying, yes, you can review the code. FBI, you can keep it secret. Does this mean that he's basically saying if the FBI agrees that it has to be secret, he's going to throw out the case? Or—
well, not throwing out the case. Then. It's just saying the FBI has the right to keep it a secret. The guy has the right to review the source code as long as he's able to get the source code, but the FBI is not required to provide their source code.
Well, that's just—
but that's insane.
That's called a catch-22.
So the judge is not saying you can review that, but you can keep it secret. And if you keep it secret, he can't review it, and therefore the case is thrown out. He's not saying that. He's saying you can review it if you can get it, sucka.
If you had access to it, that could be part right. of your— that would be part of your right to be able to do so. But the FBI is not required to provide it to you.
So in other words, the judge is saying you can't review the source code, because effectively that's what this means.
It's kind of like when you— much different level, but when people were jailbreaking iPhones, it came to be that the user could jailbreak their phone, but you were not allowed to make jailbreak software and distribute it.
Right. I remember that.
It's kind of like—
yeah, you couldn't share the knowledge of it.
Yeah, if I can't jailbreak
that
my
finally
phone.
The whole thing kind of got cleaned up finally.
Right, but I mean, it's right that now. Same situation of like if you obey one side, the other side becomes moot, which—
I think this is an interesting topic. I think we should continue this because I've got just a couple questions around the ramification of AI and these same types of questions. First, I want to invite people, though. We are now totally independent. Yay, us! No longer a radio station supporting us and our endeavor. We've been volunteering for years to keep the show going, and we want to keep on making it go. And so what we decided to do, since we're kind of launched our own endeavor, is to have a little bit of backing, a little support for the program. And we figure, since you listen to the show and love the show, maybe you'd want to contribute. So we launched a Patreon.com.
What's Patreon?
Patreon, which is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N, which is not the same word, is it?
Well, it's a play on patronage.
Yeah. Yeah, so Patreon is not— it's like, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
So, and it's GeekSpeak.
The tech
GeekSpeak.
Version of patronage.
But of course, you can just go to geekspeak.org and click on support. Geekspeak.org/support. You can learn all about this. We're basically allowing people to donate. We have like a goal of $100 a month to kind of maintain the show. That handles our bandwidth. That allow for us to grow the audience by advertising. And we're basically just going to ask anyone that's interested in supporting the show regularly to either chip in a buck, chip in $5. This is a month. Mm-hmm. $1 a month, $5 a month, or if you're
crazy
and love us, $25 a month.
Yeah, that'd be like court. And also, it's a lot cheaper to make a podcast than it is to run a radio show.
Oh yeah, I think KOSP's costs are like at minimum $40,000 a month.
Oh
yeah.
Wow.
And we're basically spending about $40,000 a month. I mean, sorry, $40 a month.
Three orders of magnitude.
Yeah, and that's actually just us being a little sloppy on the bandwidth usage. I mean, we have two servers running right now. We're not using both of them. We want to use both of them because we have redundancy and all that, but we're actually only using one, so it feels a little bit wasted. Anyway, $1 a month gives you a thank you on our website. $5 a month gives you a thank you once a month on the show. And then $25 a month gives you a thank you on every episode. And you get to listen live with us. You get to join Greg and Chandler and contribute with us live while we're recording the show. Not in Los Gatos, unless you're local.
That's Monday nights we tend to record.
That's right. And we do a hangout. So we just invite those people that are contributing at that level to join us.
Anywhere you are in the world, you can still hang out with us. I mean, time willing.
Time willing, exactly. Time willing, yeah. So learn more about that. Support us at geekspeak.org/support. All right. So the reason why I think this idea of a judge saying you can't necessarily get access to the software has to do with that accuser idea, right? That software itself is the thing that defines, in this situation, what this person has done, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some algorithm in it. There might be a bug in it, right? We don't know. How do you know? You have to trust that the FBI says that this actually happened. But normally what you do when you trust a police, you know, law enforcement, is you ask them stuff on
right. But it's also stand. But it's also a process. And you don't necessarily have access to the process that someone came to accuse you. You get to argue about the evidence produced.
So you can't say, I don't, you know, what kind of CSI like methods
did
you?
Question, like how the evidence was gathered.
I think the
right,
I
but
think
like
the evidence
can you,
gathering is completely right. important. Yeah, that's the
right.
Kind of
so
point.
So I agree with you, but there's, I mean, there's probably logistically a level to which you can ask about it, but you can't like go and collect the evidence with them, right? Or they don't necessarily videotape the collection process. Like, did you really pick up the fingerprint the right way or the wrong way? You know, mm-hmm. like
right, you might not know, right?
Right. Right.
And I think that leads back to the history of the situation, right? You go, no, our lab does this many processes of blood samples, and therefore, because of that, we kind of know we have a trust along there. And if you start arguing against that, you're basically arguing against all this precedence of using this lab.
Right.
And I think another a more simple example of this would be, a policeman's notepad that they take all their notes on. And then after that, they do a report at the office and they type it up. And the questions of like, do you still have your notebook? Have you destroyed it? Is it available? Also things of like, well, you wrote the report 6 days later. Was there any kind of text? Did you write anything down? And the police would say, yeah, I always write in my journal. And then 6 days later, I actually wrote up the report, but I had all the notes already. So the questioning of that is can be important in a quick case. But normally we just kind of understand like, oh, the police officer's doing their job. They've written things down. That makes sense. There's no holes we can poke at because we all understand the situation. But with software, nobody knows the situation, right? I mean,
well,
the three of
fully.
Us know to some degree what potentially could be problematic, what not be, could not be. But well, actually having
so we don't really know.
A lot of complex systems, even someone who has a programming background, they have the capacity to learn about it quickly. But you don't necessarily know. Like, you jump into a new company, you have no idea how their systems work.
Like, right. I literally have no idea what happens when I press the space bar on my keyboard. And it puts a space in the word processor. Like, it is so many levels deep. And actually,
advances your page down.
There are numerous write-ups on this, too. And even if we all somehow, the three of us, had all of that knowledge, it would be days and days and days, maybe years of podcasting, because there are so many levels upon levels.
I
right?
get that. I think at the same time, though, when you're in a text document or a word processor and you type something, no one's going to say, well, did you really type that? Did that software change it? Because
right.
we all have a general understanding of how the system works that new paragraphs of English is not going to just show up on your computer
right.
yet. Right? But
yet.
But as the complexity of our environment changes, that becomes a question. That should become a question. And when you're talking about a dedicated piece of software, which is malware, which inherently has to be secretive in what it's doing, and then it does things like crawl through a computer and then send back logs. Are we sure that it's sending back the right person's logs?
Are we sure that the logs came from that person's computer and not someone else's?
I've made bugs like that kind of effect, right? Where I think I'm doing the right thing and my key is actually not unique.
Yeah,
like,
logging
kind of
is really hard.
Right.
Yeah,
at the same time, coming from the other point of view, the judge's ruling that the FBI has the right to keep that source code private is if you produce that source code, it becomes relatively trivial to secure your systems against any possible use of that software.
It becomes
again.
Useless, basically.
Yeah, it becomes like, oh, you update your antivirus or anti-spyware software and that exploit doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, and except that I think making that software available to the defendant's attorneys or defendant's expert with an understanding that it cannot be shared outwardly and then taking a real good look at it or a general third party making analysis about it and saying, yes, I because of my years of experience, I spent 6 days backwards engineering this software. It looks like it's good. It's true. Or, no, I still found these six problems.
Although
that
wasn't
like
– yeah, that wasn't covered in the ruling. The ruling was talking about the guy – specifically, and the third party, that is a very good point, an excellent point. At the same time, to give it to the lawyer or the defendant does raise that question of if the person actually did engage in, I'm going to use this as the universal taboo that we all have, does engage in child porn, how can you trust them to stay with an NDA, you know, a non-disclosure agreement.
Right. I think the third party is a good way to go. And I actually say if the defendant's lawyers could actually get an expert, even from the FBI, that wasn't involved in the case with other cases and use that software regularly and was able to kind of question the pattern, that gets closer to the issue at hand, right? I mean,
I would want someone out of the FBI if I were the defendant.
If I was a defendant, I would want that too. Yeah. Well, I think that this is going to become more and more of an issue as the systems in our world become more complex.
Right. But there are several. There are a lot of computer programmers out there, people who are versed in computers and security, who have a security clearance through government. So that should not be an insurmountable hurdle.
I agree.
Assuming that we're willing to do it, because once again, it's that universal taboo. It's very easy for us to say, that seems like a really bad person. I don't want to help them, even though that's contrary to the goals of our justice system, which is you're supposed to be presumed innocent and then be afforded all opportunity for defense.
So Greg found the confrontational clause on Wikipedia. Of the Sixth Amendment of the United States, the Constitution provides that in all criminal, I'm quoting, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be confronted with the witness against him. So generally, the right is to have a face-to-face confrontation with the witness who are offering, you know, offering testimonial evidence against the accused, form of cross-examination.
Right. But that goes into your question of who is the witness. Is the witness the FBI person who's in charge of the case? Is it the person who wrote the software? Is it the person...
Is it the software itself?
Exactly.
I mean, the other aspect of
general courts don't consider software to be someone who can testify. So
I wouldn't say someone who can testify, but it's definitely the case that the police officer or the law enforcement officer that's using that system has no idea how that system works, right? So they're just blindly trusting that what they do when they infect a machine, it reports information back, it's true. They're not a software engineer.
That's not – I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily true, because there are people – in the FBI who would try to work with that to do that, and they would be the lead. They would be consultants in the process. So there may be someone who knows about it.
The understanding I have about that market of software is that it's like packaged software developed by other people and law enforcement uses it. But I don't know
either
way.
No, it could go either way.
Also, there's probably the idea that this kind of software would want to be able to be scalable, so that way they could catch more bad guys rather than having the people who wrote the software now be, you know, running the software, catching the bad guys, and not making better software to catch bad guys.
With
that'd
software,
be my assumption.
You want to see how it reacts in the wild. To get feedback and look to see what other aspects you can improve upon. That's just a general part of software. So I would assume even by having programmers out there, seeing how it reacts in the wild is part of the software development process.
Right. Okay.
Really interesting stuff, guys. Hey, Ben, I don't even know who Axnar is.
Lawsuit. Okay, so I can explain this from the beginning and you won't know about this. So... this group of people decided to create a Star Trek fan film called Axanar.
Oh, you've talked about it on the show.
Have I?
I think you have.
I've talked about fan films before. I don't know if I've talked about Axanar. But anyway, they created Axanar Productions to create this video.
And I bet Paramount wasn't very happy.
Well, I think Paramount was probably okay, because Paramount has generally kind of not gotten involved when people have made fan fiction, whether that's I don't know if they have the rights to the book series or whatnot, but if people make like extra episodes of Star Trek movies, Paramount doesn't really seem to take action. The difficulty with Axanar is that the people who were doing it decided to open a Kickstarter to fund it and possibly also to make money from it, and that's a big no-no, because they don't own the IP. They don't own the intellectual property of Star Trek.
Oh, but they were starring Chekhov, the actor who played Chekhov. Right?
Oh, what was his name?
Koenig.
Yeah, Koenig O'Brien. Koenig something. Walter. Koenig Walter. That's Walter Koenig. They also had. Oh darn it! What was his name? He played.
No, Ben never takes drugs.
I don't know what you're talking. He also there's another guy who played Kern, Worf's brother, and also old Jake Sisko in that one episode of DS9 that made me cry. Anyway.
I said there was more than one episode of Deep Space Nine that made you cry.
Oh, but that one. Okay. That one the most. Oh, man. That one's rough.
What, I think both of you try to find every excuse you can to cry. I don't know what's up with you guys.
Right.
Okay, so...
Anyway.
So they actually have some big-name actors behind this thing, and they had a Kickstarter campaign. How much money did they make on the Kickstarter campaign?
Well, big-name actors that have a history with the Star Trek canon.
A couple, and then some that obviously didn't. But I think the big no-no was that they were either funding it with other people's money or that they were trying to make money off of it. I'm unclear exactly, you know, what the indicators of which it was.
So Paramount sued them.
Paramount sued them, right. Mm-hmm. And everyone got really upset and, oh my God, how could you sue, you know, these people who are just kind of having fun with the Star Trek brand and, you know, making a fan film and everything.
Suddenly stops being a legal issue and becomes more of a PR issue.
Oh, yeah. And then, you know, other people who are diehard Star Trek fans are like, no, this is intellectual property. Like, you can't just do that. And just because it's Star Trek doesn't make it an exception, right? So, in any case...
I wonder how copyright would work in the Star Trek universe.
How what?
How copyright would work in the Star Trek universe.
Copyright.
Because all your food and stuff's taken care of, right? Like
it depends. It depends on where you are.
Okay. You know what? Wait. Maybe we'll get into this after the show.
You don't want to go into this rabbit hole with me. No.
Federation credits.
Federation.
Yeah. Okay.
No, they won't. Going to Star Wars land for a second. In any case, J.J. Abrams randomly announced at this Star Trek fan event that.
J.J. Abrams is the director of the most recent Star Trek movies.
Of the most recent Star Trek movies, not including the one that's going to come out.
Right.
He jumps ship and started doing Star Wars.
Just to give some context to who J.J. Abrams is and how he fits into this conversation.
Right. He's the one
also
who
is the director of the most recent Star Wars movies.
Yes. And he's the one who introduced lens flares to the Star Trek universe.
Yeah. Babylon 5. Okay, let's go.
Any case,
what did J.J. Abrams say
at this Star Trek fan event? He announced that the Paramount Pictures lawsuit against Axanar Productions was, quote, going away. And
they're dropping it.
Yeah. So first of all, I don't think there's been an official announcement. Second of all, I was kind of confused to hear that J.J. Abrams was the person who mentioned this rather than Paramount's legal department. But apparently the story goes that J.J. Abrams was talking with Justin, what's his name, the director of the upcoming Star Trek movie.
The new director. He's talking with
Justin
the new director.
Lin. Justin Lin. Yeah, so they were talking about how bad it was that, you know, Paramount was suing these people and everything about the and, you know, basically that fans should be able to celebrate Star Trek.
Right.
And this is, I guess, an example of that.
That's
and
cool.
It should be allowed.
I think that's kind of neat. I don't really care where it came from. I think the idea of allowing other people to make content, I mean, I don't think it's going to damage their brand, right? People are going to know it's fan fiction. It's not going to be a trademark issue because they're not going to put Paramount on it. And it's going to be fan fiction at any level.
I don't know. How many people really pay attention to the opening screen where it shows the Paramount?
You know,
they're not going to make this movie and release it, right? It's not going to be out in theaters.
No.
If it's released, it'll be free.
Although I do have to say the production value is very high. So, you know, it could be indistinguishable in terms of quality.
Because, I mean, this reminds me of Lucasfilm previously, which was people made fan stuff off of Star Wars all the time. You had Troops. The story of the Stormtrooper side of the story when you know, they see Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru. Things like the Emperor and his new how he deals with apprentices, you know, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was called Apprentice, something like that.
I thought that was a television show, The Apprentice.
No, but I mean,
I'm just
fanfic.
Kidding.
But if you ever tried making money off of Star Wars, then they came after you with
Boot. Yeah, definitely. This has been an interesting. This has just been a fascinating story.
I see
in
what
general.
You did there.
Because what?
Fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, I raised my eyebrow as well. Never mind. Anyway, it's been a fascinating story to watch because there have been all kinds of really interesting things. Like, for example, when I don't remember what the Axanar people said. They were kind of jerks about it, too. Yeah. That was probably a bad move, right? When Paramount was like, cease and desist, you don't just be jerks back. But in any case, they said something like, show us that we're infringing on your copyright. And Paramount took them to task and wrote this ridiculously long document of like Second 29 of the trailer, Klingons are mentioned. Klingons are a fictitious species from the, you know, planet Kronos. Yeah. Blah, 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 blah. Here are pictures of Klingons. And they went and they, like, found pictures that looked of, like, the same uniform and the same pose and everything and put them side by side in their amicus brief.
So that brief is actually kind of a fun read.
It's an amazing read. It's just so fun. And then in response to that, one of the things that they claimed was under copyright and owned by Paramount Pictures was the Klingon language, which was developed by Mark Ockrand during, I think, the Next Generation.
An accomplished linguist.
Like,
yes.
This is, yeah. Basically, they hired a linguist to create a language for this fictional species. And the Language Creation Society, which is a thing, apparently, filed an amicus brief in the case and made the argument that the Klingon language is not copyrightable. And that's a really fun brief to read, too, because they put in random Klingon, like, they put Klingon into the brief. Like, they do it kind of tongue-in-cheek, but they are also kind of serious.
Wait a second. So if Klingon itself is copyrightable, even the name probably, because they created it, and the language the Klingons write is a language and therefore in general is not under copyright.
Right.
That's fascinating.
But they were filing it as an amicus brief, which means it gets put into the legal record, which means that the language is now part of the legal record and therefore open for anyone to see. The same thing was pulled with Scientology. There were some things that they were talking about from Scientology. They put it into the legal record as...
And now if you want to quote, you don't quote the books and quote the doctrine of the church. Instead, you quote the legal brief that actually quotes the...
Exactly.
That's amazing.
Can we move on?
I'm happy to move on. Great. I just wanted to,
Let's go to another fan fiction thing, and that is a highly successful show, mostly because, from my perspective, it's actually accurate. A lot of it is accurate. It's called Mr. Robot. It's a TV series. And
Mr. Robot.
And it's about a good deed doer hacker.
Well, gray hat hacker.
Gray hat hacker. Yeah, yeah. And in the premiere episode was free and available still, I think, all over the place. You can watch it on YouTube, the very first episode. Mm-hmm. And
USA Network.
It's on USA Network. Tell me why you're talking about Mr. Robot.
Well, the funny thing is, of course, any show is going to have a website. And so there is a website for Mr. Robot on the USA Network. But hackers have been going on there, White Hat hackers, finding security exploits within that page and reporting them to try to get the page to be more secure. So they're patching cross-site security bugs on, you know, or to...
on the website that promotes Mr. Robot.
Yes. You know, fixing SQL injection errors stuff like that. And I just want to give a shout-out to it just because Mr. Robot was a great show.
Is it over?
I don't know that it's over. The first season is complete. Okay. I haven't heard anything about the second season.
I've been waiting for a big block of it to be watchable because I only watch things on binge mode.
The entire first season is there.
Yeah, okay. I'll have to do that now. That's not an uncommon thing. I run the Woz.org, Steve Wozniak's website, and with Al, and I've had people mention vulnerabilities on it because. Who's going to attack Woz's website, right? I mean, it was pretty cool. So we had some, like, early on, so we had some problems with it. And we finally, what we did is we just removed the whole CMS. Is now no longer public, right? And it just publishes HTML documents raw. That's just a lot safer.
It's so much safer.
And that's all automated and everything. So it means that when we update, it's like a half an hour before it actually updates. But, hey. And also, when Jobs passed away, Woz's website actually didn't go down. Well, it went down for a minute until we turned back on the cache to a little longer, and then it stayed up, which was kind of nice.
But yeah, the USA Network is now getting free penetration testing.
Because of their awesome show. That's pretty cool. All right. The second thing I want to mention to people, if you Patreon's great. You can donate and you don't get anything else back really from us except for little gifts, and that's wonderful. But some people are thinking, actually, I'd like to support my business by advertising on GeekSpeak. And we're kind of like, okay, yeah, we could do that, right?
Hey, could I advertise GeekSpeak on GeekSpeak?
Yes.
Would that?
We do it every time.
I don't
So we're going to offer...
Watch GeekSpeak, now found on your podcast, Wednesdays.
The way that weblogs work, it's a little harder to process exactly what kind of downloads we have per episode, but the count looks like to be around 3,000 downloads per episode right now.
It's not bad.
Not bad. I think the CPM for podcasts, the cost per thousand.
Cost per thousand.
For an ad read on a podcast is between $40 and $60 per thousand. Okay. So that's kind of what the area is. But we're not making any money yet. We're not advertising yet. So we're totally willing to talk with you. The geeks, we've all decided, though, if we're going to take an advertiser, it's only going to be a company that we agree with, that we can support. So we're not going to be doing what wouldn't we do?
Vitamins.
Some vitamins would be good.
Well,
I take vitamins.
No, maybe like things that promote pseudoscience, things that are obviously exploitative. Like,
yeah,
for example,
totally
someone says, like a check cashing firm, we're not going to have them on there,
right.
Just to throw out there.
Right, right. But a good hosting provider or...
We'll be generally quite discerning, I think.
Yeah, yeah. We're all going to decide. And therefore, if you're interested in potentially advertising with us, we have a broad reach. We're mostly in California, but we're actually all over the planet. Go ahead and email geeks@geekspeak.org and start a conversation with us. Okay. Let's move on.
Cool. So I was trying to donate to GeekSpeak, and I typed a bunch of stuff in the web form.
Yeah,
and
we have a contact form.
Yeah, and then I pressed backspace, and...
and you weren't in the text field.
I wasn't. I guess I somehow wasn't in the text field. And instead of deleting the letter, it went back to the previous page. And I had written a whole bunch of stuff. So I went forward again, and sure enough... Everything was gone because it took me back and then I had to go
forward.
That's
the thing. Firefox tends to be better about that. Like you hit back and you go back forward. The stuff is still in the text boxes.
Yeah, I was in Chrome. This actually, I'm joking, but this actually did happen to me recently and I did lose probably about 5 minutes of work. And
yeah, it's really aggravating.
It's really, really frustrating when that happens.
And basically, long ago, people decided that Backspace should be a navigation feature to go back. And it kind of makes sense, but when you go back a space, that's really bad. And really, all they have to do is if you've typed anything in the page, don't make the back button go back anymore.
Okay,
I mean, how hard is that?
Well, apparently a little hard because Chrome is going to do this, and this is actually what my story is that
or
Chrome
going to
is
stop doing it. Yeah.
It's going to remove the default backspace event handler. Basically, when you press backspace, it's not going to go back to the previous page.
What's it going
to
do?
I assume nothing. Let me see.
It doesn't say here. Backspace when you're in a text box and nothing if you're not in a text box.
If anyone wants to follow along, this is issue number. Oh, hold on. I got to put the commas
this
in.
It'll be issue number
1,854,000.
Yeah, thank you.
Anyway. So, oh, God. 1 billion. Anyway.
But that does remind me, though, that I wish that they would also fix, not the Chrome people, the YouTube people, the number one bug that bothers me, which is you go to launch a YouTube video on your laptop,
mm-hmm.
and then you know there's something going on, so you need to pause it.
Yeah,
you,
yeah.
You think to go, oh, well, I hit spacebar because that's a normal thing.
Spacebar is always what pauses and plays.
Unless the video isn't in focus, in which case the page jumps down to the next page. Which
it
is
scrolls
never
down.
What I, yeah, it scrolls down, which is never what I want when I'm watching a YouTube video.
Again, if the browser, when it's playing a video, if the space bar just should attach to the video playing.
I'm actually thinking in terms of the folks who run YouTube, just make it so that space bar disables
doesn't
the default
scroll.
Behavior of
okay,
the browser.
Don't disable the default behavior of a browser.
Yes,
ooh, I just
absolutely.
Strangle you. No.
No, yes. Yes.
No.
I'm sorry. When you're on Google Docs right now.
Hang on a second.
When you do Control C, Control V, are you disabling the default browser behavior? Yes.
Well, technically,
you're
speaking.
Overriding it with some other behavior that is more appropriate to the context
the behavior,
that you're in at the moment.
But Miles,
yeah, but it
the
does
behavior
exactly what I
does
expected to do.
It does exactly the same thing.
Yeah,
well,
and when
website,
I'm on YouTube and I hit the space bar, I want the video to pause.
Okay,
that's what I expect.
But you never use space bar to navigate web pages?
I do.
Do you? If you do, that's the default behavior of a web page.
Well,
you see the problem? There's two default behaviors, and they collide with each other.
Exactly. So you have the default behavior of a video, which is to play pause when you press spacebar, and then you've got a website where you press spacebar, and you're supposed to scroll down.
And what happens on
YouTube?
So
I
when
take
you
your
do
point,
a lot of reading,
stop having spacebar be the default.
I'm yeah. I don't know. I like navigating with the spacebar.
I want to go back to the backspace story and say, man, you guys got heated there.
Did you just click us backspace?
I just hit backspace. Yeah. So actually, on this issue, on Chromium Code Reviews, it says that their use counters show that 0.04% of page views navigate back using the backspace button, and 0.005% of those page views are after a form interaction. So in other words, 1 in 8 are immediately after a form interaction, which means that probably a good percentage of those 1 in 8 are people who are really unhappy and they're losing data. I also just want to briefly read one of these comments. So shortly after this went out, and it started to get rolling out to to people in Chrome Canary, someone filed a bug on it and said, steps to reproduce the problem, open Chrome, surf to a page in page 2, press backspace, and what's the expected behavior? It's supposed to navigate back, but what went wrong? It doesn't. So what's going on? Basically, they're saying...
They filed a bug against the new change.
Yeah, yeah. They're filing a bug saying that my backspace doesn't
go
back anymore.
They're one of the 7 of 8.
They're one of the 7 of 8. Well... Yeah, that's true. So anyway, immediately after, of course, one of the developers says this is likely related to and then links to the issue. And I like this this comment because I think this person actually means it seriously, but it reads a little bit sarcastically. It says, how is someone who grew up in terminal times expected to navigate back using a two-button mouse? Are you suggesting the only remaining options are alt left, a two-hand key combo for which I have to move my mouse hand towards the keyboard and then back, and the back button left of the Omnibox? Yeah.
Interesting.
Or you could get one of the 20 billion...
Chrome extensions,
mice out there that have more than 3 buttons.
Oh, actually, like, this person is complaining about that, how the 4th button no longer does go back. Apparently, it used to work and doesn't work now.
Probably a backspace button.
I was supposed to say, that's all those mice that come with like 5 buttons or whatever, like a logic that's like
that,
they're programmable.
But what is the keystroke that does that now?
It should be alt back.
Yeah, so
alt back
assign
arrow.
That to you. Okay.
If you are adversely impacted by this change, you can download a Chrome extension that does the exact same thing.
Sure.
Now, we talked about XKCD earlier. There is an XKCD for this.
Oh, is there?
No matter what
feature. For losing the form feature?
No matter how innocent you think this feature is or how useful it can be, there's always someone that's going to mess up their workflow. Uh-huh. So it talks about you do this key combination and it causes CPUs to overheat in a uh-huh. tight loop. And you fix the bug, and you have some bug report coming in. No, that was part of my workflow where I'd hit that key, and it would act as a warmer for my house because it's really cold, and I can't.
Right, okay. You're always going to piss someone off.
So, the back button thing, I don't understand why they're not implementing it such that if you put any input into the page, it doesn't do back anymore. Like, what's the problem? That's so simple, so simplistic.
But it makes it less reliable. So, like. If you have,
it makes it a little less reliable. But if you're overriding that stuff and having other input methodologies, the JavaScript engineer is doing that, then it's their problem to deal with that. Most of the time, form fields are form fields, and typing is typing. If you've entered anything into the page, boom.
But tell me, like name 5 websites off the top of your head that don't have form fields on them. I mean, most websites have form fields.
I'm not saying form fields exist. I'm saying a person's typed anything in a form field.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Make a pop-up that says, "Hey, do you want to go back?"
And... If they've created any content that potentially could be a GET request or POST request, stop making it. You know, it's like it seems so simple.
You know what? I'll bet.
But it'd be more complex.
I'll bet a bunch of really smart engineers at Google had this exact conversation over the course of 5 days.
Turn it off.
And they decided, you know.
Okay, and back to Miles' spacebar thing. My point was, because we never finished that, because Ben was like, calm down, guys. My point is that there's 2 default behaviors that are colliding, and you're not disabling the default behavior. You're overriding it with the other default behavior. And that I agree with 100%. If there's a video playing, or even a video in a prominent space on the site, that the space bar should be consumed by that video. That's totally fine with me. But don't change the default. Like, you see what I'm saying?
Then why is there an event prevent default method?
you're saying that anybody that puts a video on there should just add the prevent default of space bar and then fix it?
If it matches their workflow, yeah.
Okay,
if
so
it's intuitive.
That's the problem. You want YouTube to do that.
I want YouTube to be intuitive, yeah.
Yeah, you should do that. You should get a job there or something. So you have a kind of sad and depressing story.
I do.
Yeah.
Really? What's sad and depressing?
About men being horrible.
Oh, yeah, that is sad and depressing.
Yeah.
Yeah, this comes from 538.com.
What is that?
Yeah, what is that? Because I've been seeing that, and it's more than random chance.
538 is started by a gentleman whose name Joel Silver. Or Nate Silver. No, Nate Silver.
Nate Silver of politics, yes, predicting elections.
Exactly.
It's
now owned by
ESPN. Used to have a blog with New York Times, and now it's 538.com.
That's where I've heard of it.
And it's ESPN. It's a property of ESPN, it looks like.
Oh, really? Okay.
And what he found, I mean, this is not by Nate Silver. This is actually a contributor to that website, but everyone who contributes on that website is usually well-versed in statistics.
Walt
and
Hickey
data,
is the author of this one.
Data gathering, where they looked at TV reviews of shows. And so you have your shows that have a demographic that is very clearly aimed toward men. And you have demographic shows that are very clearly aimed at women. That's their demographic. That's where the ads are showing up. It's like
they make the content for certain people.
Yes, exactly. The shows that are aimed at women are performing more poorly with regard to online reviews. The reason being is that while when women watch a show that's targeted toward men, they tend to be like, well, that's not for me. I'm going to go watch something else. Whereas more men will see the show aimed at women and then get very upset and trash the show in online comments.
Mm-hmm.
And so the aggregate effect is you end up with shows that have a female focus tend to be rated lower.
I see. So basically you're saying because men talk more and complain more, the things they don't like are downgraded.
They don't talk more, but they do complain more vociferously.
Yeah.
About a problem.
Well, I think
or
in
what
general,
they perceive as a problem.
I think in general men in our
complain
society,
more?
Well, not necessarily complain more, but have this feeling of righteousness that they should be able to speak about what they think, right? So there's this idea that their opinion is more important.
Isn't that called – there's a word for that.
Male privilege, I think is what's
yeah,
called.
Yeah, 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 privilege.
Also, we kind of live in a world where these things are much more often made for men than they are for women. And so as a result, if you have a show that's made for women, then it's a departure from the norm, which men get all – you know, stupid about, or people in general might get stupid about. But if you have a show that's manly, like Tool Time or something, I don't know, that's not really a departure from the norm. That's kind of the status quo. And so it's accepted.
So the one they have is Sex and the City, as in the quote on this article, has an overall rating of 7.0 on a scale of 1 to 10. The average score for an English language television series with 1,000 or more ratings is 7.3. So why did the show roundly considered seminal in the new genre go so
a show that defined a new genre,
yeah,
effectively.
Yeah, they really did. Good show.
Nearly 60% of the people who rated Sex and the City on IMDb are women. And if you just use their scores, the show has an 8.1,
mm-hmm.
Noticeably higher than the average. But the male users, which made up just over 40%, gave it an average of 5.8.
You know, statistically, men should shut up more. I'm just saying. If you're a man and you're in a space where you feel like you should speak, just 10% of the time, hold that back.
Consider
that
not.
That would help a lot.
And if you're the type of person that thinks, why should I have to silence my opinion? You need to hold back about 20%. I'm just saying.
Awesome.
Hey, should we have a brief moment of silence?
Okay,
nah.
That's over.
Three minute podcast.
Okay, so we're going to do two more stories. We're going to have a story from Ben about data usage, and then Miles is going to tell us all about... I think actually we're going to have a new segment to close out the end of the show, because it sounds like such an obvious thing. Copyright wrong. So
copyright
we'll cover
wrong.
Copyright wrong at the end of the show. Miles will have one of those. But first, Ben, what's up with mobile data?
Oh, I just had a quick one, which is that Americans this last year used almost 10 billion gigabytes of mobile data.
10 billion gigabytes. So is that a trillion megabytes?
It's a trillion megabytes.
Trillion, sorry, 10 trillion
which
megabytes.
Is a quadrillion, which is a quadrillion kilobytes, which is a quintillion bytes. What's a quintillion bytes?
So let's see. You got
giga, tera, peta,
exa.
Exa. Is that right?
Are we going above exa here?
I don't know.
No, we're not. Because okay. The show's over. Okay.
You are wise, sir. You are wise. So we like our mobile data. I guess the only other thing I have to say on this story is I really wish mobile data was priced a little bit better, right? We're using it so much, but, you know, those companies are making bank on it. Definitely. At least text messages aren't 20 cents anymore. Wait, are they? For some people, I think.
But yes, it's 10 exabytes.
10 exabytes. Okay, thank you for doing that, because as we established, I should not try and do math while talking.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence's use of permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you like it. Just let them know the geek said hi. I want to thank our intern, Chandler, who supports the website and all that, and does great things, and also Greg Merkley, who today supported us fantastically with data along the show, and is also titling this episode, Shining Sunlight on the FBI's Backspace Button. Theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. And thank you for being here for episode 21 of our 16th season. Miles?
Always a pleasure.
I was actually saying, Miles, your last story.
I was going to say. Sure.
Copy wrong. Copyright
the
wrong.
The copy wrong.
I think it's copyright wrong.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, there are two stories. One is from The Guardian about how copyright law is being misused to remove material for the internet. But there's a specific case that I wanted to bring up. This is from Torrent Freak. Yes, that's the name of a site. Which is the story is titled Fox Stole a Game Clip, Used It in Family Guy, and DMCA the Original. Now, what this means is there's a person who found a hack, an Easter egg, a little thing that they could do to Jimmy the Game to give you extra points.
What like, game?
Double Dribble. It's an old game about basketball.
Okay.
And I actually played it back in the day, and it was fun.
Atari age?
Yeah, somewhere around there. Yeah.
Okay. Cartridge game though, or
yes.
Okay,
I mean cartridge game is that's a lot of games before PlayStation. Everything was a cartridge game.
Well, no, you had games on.
Oh, I guess you had the Sega Genesis.
Well, you also had games on Apple II, and I mean, is that a non-cartridge?
Oh,
games?
Yeah, true. Okay, it's sideway. Yeah,
side note.
So this person made a YouTube video of this. From what I'm aware of, it might be an unknown hack ahead of time. And Fox, or at least the folks behind Family Guy, took that clip, incorporated it into an episode.
A Family Guy,
showing the YouTube clip itself, not like reproducing it, but actually putting
showing
in
the thing
clip.
Itself. Yeah, that seems kind of cool for the guy.
Right, except that Fox then... sent a Digital Millennium Copyright Act takedown notice to YouTube.
Of the original guy?
Saying, yeah, of that YouTube video saying, nope, we own it. It's part of our Family Guy episode.
Oh, no.
And YouTube took it down.
Oh, no. Okay, so that's probably so two bad. Automated systems gone wrong, right? Okay, I mean, it's probably not malicious, right? Like, the people at Fox, I don't think
I'm sure they're
going
sure to backtrack that one.
Oh, that's yeah. That was probably just an automated system. Yeah. And then YouTube accepting it was also probably an automated system
totally.
Saying, yeah, well, it looks like legit it. To me.
You got to trust those big boys that have lots of money. I love the idea that what about the question of, like, the company that made the original game, Double Dribble? The imagery on that is theirs.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. So you have another level of copyright.
Potential infringement.
Awesome first episode of Copy Wrong or Copyright Wrong. Thank you very much, Miles. And thanks,
Ben.
Did
you just invent that just now?
Yeah.
Nice.
But then again, nothing's unique. Everything's a derivative.
Yeah.
Up, up, down, down, left, right.
A, B, A, B?
It's the geek equivalent, a gamer geek equivalent of knock knock or shaving a haircut.
Two right. bits. Miles, Ben, thanks so much for being here on the 21st episode of our 16th season.
Thank you, Lyle.
Always a pleasure.